Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is the Toronto Film Festival Series Edition 2023 extravaganza. And I'm probably doing fewer episodes since I did a whole bunch in Venice and there's some overlap. I'm pleased to be moving through another batch of titles with Beatrice Loaiza. Hello. And you're back from Toronto too. Full disclosure, we are both back.
Yes, we are both back in New York.
And this is your third trip there, or I forget?
Actually, Toronto was the first film festival I went to.
Oh, cool.
I went for the first time as a non-press person.
Oh, in what capacity were you there?
No capacity. I was starting to write at that point, but I just, you know, convinced my boyfriend at the time that it'd be fun to go. And because, you know, I'd been to Toronto before and it was just like a fun town with good food. And, you know, I just thought, why not feel out what the film festival experience is like? Yeah, no, I mean, I think that first time was like 2017 or something like that.
But this time you were writing, filing, or what were you writing?
I wasn't.
Oh, you were?
No, I was there with an industry badge, actually. My good friend, Dorota Lek, is a programmer at the festival. She programs the discovery section.
Of course, yes.
She invited me, or she gave me a badge, and I crashed at her place. So it was, you know, partly business because, you know, watching all of these films obviously is good for our sort of panoramic perspective of contemporary film, but also, you know, for pleasure as well.
Yeah, of course. So just to make clear for listeners, I think people are aware of this, but I'm not going to be covering things that have been on like the Cannes podcast or the Venice podcast. Well, we will be talking about one title that I didn't talk about in a Berlin podcast, which is a good thing. I forget if it was either programmed weirdly or shown at a weird time or was in a weird section. The Teacher's Lounge. There were people who saw it and thought it was really good. And I think it even maybe won something. And I think Sony Pictures Classics picked it up.
Yeah.
And I guess I could sketch out the premise because it's interesting. Like you can do it in a line and then it's just kind of how the movie iterates off that afterwards, which I think is a great strength of it. So it's set in this German grade school and it centers on a teacher who is very well-meaning and is really put off by the anti-theft searches that are going on in the school, which are immediately recognizable as the sort of heavy-handed thing a school would do, where they're searching for who stole something, and then it zeroes in, of course, you know, on one kid. But then it appears that the same thing happens to the teacher in the teacher's lounge, that there appears to be some theft. And I'm just keeping it open. It just plays it out from there. And this was one of your highlights from the festival?
Yeah, I really like this one. I mean, I have some problems, I guess, with some of like the elements it blends in. Like, so, I mean, the strength of the film is that it has this great sense of momentum. There's a sort of a snowball effect because, you know, the teacher tries to take these thefts into her own hands because she sees that, you know, the way the school is dealing with it is kind of authoritarian and is sort of seeing the administrators show their asses a bit, like kind of racially, because like the way they're targeting some students.
Yeah, exactly.
Is a bit questionable. And so she tries to take into her own hands. And yeah, I mean, I won't get into the details, but that kind of pulls the thread into this whole scandal that like brings in her class questioning her authority and one of the students who's the son of an administrator, and it kind of blows up where like even the students become involved. There's like a student paper that blows it up even further. And meanwhile, like the administrators are also like for and against her. So she's kind of caught in the middle of everything. And you know, some of those suspense twists, I like, especially with the student writers, I found a little unbelievable, but but just as a whole, I just thought it had like a great sense of movement. Like it reminded me of a sort of Safdie Brothers movie in the sense that you don't really stop to catch your breath at any moment. Like things just keep on going and she's just racing around the school, desperate to try to just catch her bearings because things keep getting thrown at her. And so I thought the film just, you know, was able to sort of capture that tension in a really effective way.
Yeah, and I think the actress is Léonie Benesch.
Oh, yeah, she's great. Yeah, she's and a bunch of other acclaimed German things.
She plays really well this character. She's the epitome of like flawed character, like flawed human being, like all of us basically.
Right.
She's trying to run like a fair and nice and, you know, enriching classroom. But at the same time, she just can't ignore that an injustice has occurred, especially when she's something is stolen from her.
Mm-hmm.
And she has to run it down. And I mean, it is kind of tragic. It's like the definition of tragic because she has to rectify it in some way, even if it ends up pulling her into a whole whirlpool of the usual, you know, the usual just maelstrom of these, these kind of school situations. So she's really great at that.
I really like that it doesn't place sympathies on like anyone. Like, I feel like it's not, if not objective, but like, you know, it kind of shows both sides of like how she's in the wrong, but also, you know, worth sympathizing with. And the students as well, you know, they're not entirely sympathetic either, even though we're rooting for them in a sense. And they're obviously like the most vulnerable parties in this whole situation, as well as, you know, some of the administrators. Like, I feel like it's just very even-handed with just like evaluating all the players and then sort of the pros and cons of their places.
Yeah, just trying to think of the name of the documentary about a German school, Mr. Bachmann and his class, because I remember watching this and during it thinking, oh, this is like, you know, the kind of sinister version of Mr. Bachmann and his class. It's like the less utopian version. There's no Mr. Bachmann here. There's just her name is Ms. Novak, which is actually also the name of the teacher in the Jessica Hausner film from Cannes this year.
Oh, right. And they both have like sort of bobs.
Yeah.
White women with bobs.
and reddish. Yeah, the kind of reddish,
yeah,
reddish hair.
Right.
I guess, you know, there are moments when you wonder, is the suspense going to take some Hanukkahian kind of constrictive form where like no one's really looking good? But I don't think it goes in that direction. So it's a movie that kind of felt fresh by not resorting to a stringency that feels less than human, if that makes sense. I agree about the newspaper. I mean, those kids, they really hold the line.
I know. Yeah, no, there were, I mean, this is just like my, I guess, crueler instincts. It's just like, oh my God, I like can't stand these kids.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And I guess if you're a teacher, you have to have these sorts of like firm beliefs and just like, no, we have to protect the students. We have to go out of our way to like, you know, even make things difficult for ourselves in order to make decisions that are in their interests. But I do feel like she sometimes martyrs herself for, you know, some of the students in her class in a way that I was just like, wow, she's unbelievably just morally upright or sticking to her beliefs in a way that I was like, well, if a kid had treated me that way, oh my God, I don't know. I don't know if I'd be able to hold the line.
Yeah. So yeah, that's the Teacher's Lounge, S' for punctuation fiends out there. So the next one we can talk about, actually you can talk about it because I haven't seen it, and that is Arthur and Diana.
Yeah. So this is a German production, but it's got pan-Western European feel to it. That's kind of part of it, whole thematic. So it's essentially like a hangout road trip movie. It follows the writer-director, Sarah Suma, who plays, I guess, like a version of herself. It's sort of like an auto-fictional movie, and it's her and her brother. And they're taking this road trip from Berlin through France, where they visit their mother, and they end up in this funeral for a relative in Italy. And like the way it sort of passes through these various countries, like the characters know all three languages, and you kind of don't really get a sense of like, what is their nationality? It's like they're all of them. So there's that element, but it's also has a throwback texture to it. It was shot with like a combination of like 16 millimeter and mini DV. So there's a sort of VHS quality to it. So there's that, in addition to the fact that clearly it had some sort of mumblecore influence to it. Like the characters, it's hard to talk about like what this film really is about because they're pretty much just hanging out and like there's lots of visual gags and the characters are like these bohemian types. Like they're making this whole trip and they have Sarah's son with them. Like he must be, you know, at most 5. And so they're like camping and like going to parties and stopping at people's houses. And the kid is just with them. But like the kid vibes with the whole thing. And so it's, you know, this weird bohemian sort of way of doing things that is part of what creates the comedy. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it's just, it's really just beautiful to look at it and bask in the images. The way a lot of it is shot is through sort of like through indirection. So there's like a lot of close-ups from interesting angles, and the way things are visualized is not entirely directly, so you don't see like the full picture of what's happening. But then, like I was saying earlier about the visual gags, like for instance, there's this one scene where the car stops and you know, the sister is vomiting profusely on like the side of the road. And then the brother and the kid are just playing with a soccer ball on the other side. And then like the car is in the middle of them and it's kind of splitting the shot. So there's like a lot of interesting, the way that, you know, the people are arranged in the frame, that is just like really amusing and interesting and funny to watch. And just random stuff like that, where there's also a scene where she's on the trampoline and she's like holding a giant block of cheese as she's having a conversation. I was watching it with a friend who was like, oh, like, I can't take it. It's too French. Because of, you know, there's a sort of laid back weirdo quality to it. But I don't know. I thought it was really, really beautiful. And I'm looking forward to, you know, whatever they do next. I think this might be a feature debut.
Hmm, wow.
That's my rambling about Arthur and Diana, which I think parallels the mode of the film itself. Like, I don't know how to like zone in on any one thing, because there's just sort of a cornucopia of various little like treats in there.
Sounds like it's like the sort of movie that looks easier than it must be to make, you know? I mean, making something look sort of bohemian in how it's unfolding and people's lives and everything, that I, you know, it's so easy to make that look really hackneyed really quickly. I guess, yeah, for your friend, it did just feel too French at a certain point.
I was like, excuse me, it's not just French. They're also, I guess, Italian and German, but
yeah.
But it's interesting because the film, it seems like the sort of thing that would be like purely improvised. But I stayed a little bit for a Q&A, and apparently the whole thing was very, very thoroughly scripted, like to the T, which I think reflects what you were saying about how difficult it is to kind of make things come together and seem loose when they're actually, you know, pretty drawn out in a rigid manner.
No, this sounds really interesting. I hope it travels somewhere further. I did have one question about, which is, how much is there a sense of like, these are people from now doing this thing now, you know, like about a particular generation or something like that? How much is there a sense of that?
I mean, I do think it is set in the now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, something about the visual aesthetic and the fact that they're often in nature and, you know, instead of stopping at a hotel or something, they often camp. So, you know, the fact that they're often in these natural settings and seem to be doing things in an alternative way is just, it could, you know, arguably be sort of ripped out of time. Because the technology aspect, I mean, they have phones in them, mm-hmm. but they're kind of like older model of phones, but I don't necessarily think that's because they were trying to set the film in an older model, but so much as the characters would have those kinds of phones. They're not constantly on their phones. They're
right.
Citizens of the world type people.
And it seems kind of cool to mention that the cinematographer, since you mentioned that the, you know, compositions are interesting, also shot What Do We See When We Look at the Sky?
Oh, right. Yes, that crucial element.
That sounded interesting.
Yeah.
So that is Arthur and Diana. Maybe we can squeeze in just a couple other mentions or something. For my part, I mean, I mentioned this kind of because I sort of couldn't believe what was happening sometimes. But it's this movie Naga, which is a movie from Saudi Arabia about a young woman who's trying to get to a party, and she has a very strict dad, and she goes on a basically road trip with like a sketchy friend of hers. It was just kind of funny to watch this filmmaker like really try to impress you with a camera that is absolutely acrobatic and bizarre and makes like an Aronofsky early film look very grounded. And ultimately it just goes too far. Like it's sort of a mess, but for a while, it's a really fun, hectic, exhausting movie. Actually, it's funny. I didn't even mean to pair it after the road trip one you just described. But I had to see it. I was curious. It's a Midnight Madness movie. And at a certain point, it has that Midnight Madness feeling of like, whoa, this is so crazy. Look how crazy we are to be watching this crazy thing. But just also notable to be coming out of Saudi Arabia, this weird, energetic movie with a rabid camel who constantly trying to, I don't even know what the camel wants to do. I guess bite the main character. Anyway, that's Naga. And do you have a film you want to mention, short or long?
Yeah, I'll just mention, I guess, a few short films, all in the wavelength section. So disclaimer, I am friends with a filmmaker, Blake Williams, but I genuinely do love his work. But his new film, Labyrinth Sequences, was, I think, a short that preceded another feature. He works in 3D and sort of manipulating 3D in novel ways that I don't really think I've seen in any other contemporary filmmaker. And so this experimental short was shot in this garden labyrinth in Spain. And it sort of begins as sort of rearranged sequences of static shots going through this labyrinth. But then it devolves into something very, very unexpected and has footage incorporated from a 1950s film, like gothic horror film, also set in a labyrinth. And the way that's integrated is, you know, just a really, really brilliant. And, you know, also features a section with the actress Dara Campbell, who was in that Canadian film, like Anne from, is it 10,000 feet?
13,000 feet.
Okay, yes. So, you know, it's at once impossible to spoil it because it's an experimental film. But you know, I won't get into it more. It's also going to be playing at NYFF, but that was really great.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw the Wavelengths 2 program, like their sort of program of short films, and which, you know, in general, I thought was a really strong program. But I really liked this film, Light, Noise, Smoke, and Light, Noise, Smoke, by a Japanese filmmaker, Tomonari Nishikawa. The concept is super simple. It's literally just sort of rhythmically edited shots of fireworks. But, you know, the way that he brings the footage together, it sort of decontextualizes the fact that they're fireworks, and it literally becomes reduced to the light, noise, and smoke that is in the title. In a way that, you know, I found really effective. I mean, that's just like, that film is only a few minutes long, but, you know, I would recommend it since people stumble upon it.
Yeah. And, well, actually, just one more thing I was curious about, because you mentioned you saw Memory.
Oh, yeah.
There are movies of his that just somehow escape me, and I don't really know how to explain it. And in this case, there was just something that maybe I understood differently, and then it changed the whole movie from what other people's experiences have been from talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, were you a fan?
Yeah, I don't know. I've been having conflicted feelings about it because I historically do not think Michel Franco is a good filmmaker. I mean, like, to his credit, I think he's really good at just like creating a sense of suspense. Like, his movies are not, like, they're easy to watch. Like, they go down very easy. And he's like visually, you know, very competent. So it's weird because, I mean, he's just like, politically, I find him very retrograde, and you know, his movies clearly think they're much smarter than they actually are. But anyways, with this movie,
you're roasting him alive here in passing.
No, I mean, I'm so conflicted about Memory because I like it more than anything I've seen from him. And I think it's just because the subject matter is like less obviously like politically charged or less sort of anchored to, you know, neoliberal politics and class warfare, like his recurring subjects. And I thought the performances were frankly excellent. There are individual moments in that film that I was genuinely moved by, but then in the context of the entire film, which I was pretty skeptical of, I just kind of struggled to reconcile the two. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. Have you already talked about the film? Like,
yeah, no, I mean, I haven't talked about it. Just so people know. I mean, it says Jessica Chastain plays a social worker.
She works at like an adult daycare center.
Yes, and she goes to like a high school reunion, and a guy like follows her home, basically, who is a former schoolmate, not a classmate. I guess he is older than her. And then as it goes along, she's more and more uneasy, and it's revealed to us, or she says, that he was probably among this group of guys who abused her. And Peter Sarsgaard plays this guy who follows her home. He has dementia, which it's an unusual experience for the movie because, you know, Sarsgaard as an actor, I think, still reads as middle-aged, not really yet the age that people associate with dementia usually. So maybe that's also why I was wondering if the movie, especially given Franco's kind of MO, which is...
Right, the provocateur.
Yeah, and to kind of lead us down a path. And in this case, I'm primed to wonder if Sarsgaard's character is actually willfully forgetting the awful things he may have done or he did, you know? So that was something I got stuck on. And then I couldn't really get into the rest of the movie because how do I evaluate how I feel about him, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I was also curious about that, but I decided that he does genuinely have dementia and doesn't remember any of these past occurrences.
The other thing is that she also says, oh, I guess maybe you weren't one of those guys.
Yeah, her sister confirmed. And so that I think that's the intended provocation of the film, is that he has dementia, but then she's really crippled by this sort of trauma of being like sexually abused as a young, like I think she was like 13 or 12 or something like that. And so, you know, she has this terrible or non-relationship with her mother because her mother wouldn't believe her when she was younger and said that she was abused by her father. And because of, you know, that sort of fraught dynamic, you know, apparently she had, and this is sort of ambiguous, potentially invented stories about other people abusing her as a sort of just indication of her fraught state of mind. And as such, she, like her sister, discovers some factoid that proves that the Peter Sarsgaard character, you know, was not even in the same, like he didn't, wasn't even in the same city at the time that she, you know, was the age that she said that she was abused by these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there is ambiguity about her, about the Jessica Chastain character, but I think that he was ultimately innocent in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, some of the ambiguity of, you know, what's going on there is sort of a cop out. And I also feel like strange about the film in that sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's also because there's an ambiguity that feels, that's the Franco thing. The ambiguity where it's like, oh, this is kind of crappy of you to be ambiguous about something like that, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know.
But I don't think it's ambiguous about the fact that she was abused by her
father. No.
That is clear, but I think there's ambiguity about like, how that affected her own memory and experiences after the fact.
That's true,
Which feels a bit better to me because like that feels a little bit more believable to me, but you know, still has me on my toes a little bit about it. So all of that is, I don't know, makes me hard to wrap my head around the film, but you know, just the fundamental, the romance of it and how these two people are clearly just mentally unwell. And like the way the actors are able to sort of forge a connection almost like intuitively through their lapses in memory, through the way that they hurt. Like there's this really beautiful sex scene. And I pretty much credit Jessica Chastain for pulling it off, where you can like see her kind of pushing and pulling between wanting to like let herself go and sort of embrace the experience, but then she's tentative about it and is also pulling back at the same time. And like the way that expresses, you know, just kind of how damaged she is and how big of a deal it is for her to sort of release herself into any kind of sexual encounter, I thought was really beautifully done. And so this goes back to what I was saying earlier about how individual moments in the film like really won me over, but like I don't know if that makes the film itself good.
Right. Yeah. And it is tough with his films. I mean, just this phenomenon where you have a director with his particular like mindset and tendencies, but pair him with an actor or two actors who can take it in some other direction and give it some life of its own that kind of exceeds what sometimes are very tricky scenarios he sets up. Although weirdly, of the two of them, it was Sarsgaard who won the award at Venice.
Yeah, he was fine, but he also kind of was like the, I don't know, played the sort of holy idiot character at times.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, sometimes he was convinced, I mean, he was, I guess, good, but like the direction of the character was a bit too, with his little scarf and pea coat, just being like, what's going on?
I forget if it has a distributor for the US or not.
Oh, it will, though. It's such a New York film, too. I will give it credit for that. The location shots are beautiful.
But yeah, it's a movie worth, and it was world premiered at Venice, but pretty late in the game, I guess the Thursday, I think. So,
you know, I myself was surprised that I liked it. I actually accidentally saw it because I was shut out of the holdovers. And I was, well, now what do I do? And then I ended up seeing, you know, the new Michelle Franco.
That's kind of great. I think that's almost like a perfect place to end because I think it captures something about festivals and I just movie going generally. I mean, I'm sure I can't come up with it now, but there has definitely been some movie that has ended up being very important to me or even just interesting that I saw by chance, especially at a place like Toronto where there, no joke, are 10 to 15 options at any given time period that you might find yourself flowing towards. But and also hilarious substitution, accidental replacement of the holdovers with it's like anti-film memory or something. All right, well, we can finish up there. Do you think you'll be writing anywhere on it?
No, I'm probably not writing about TIFF. I'm sure okay. I'll be writing about some of the films we discussed down the road, but I'm not writing any TIFF exclusive recap. This is it.
This is it. Okay. Well, very happy it could be here.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.